And you're listening to it on 89.3 KPECC. A very good afternoon to you. I'm Larry Mantle. Today, day two of the open impeachment inquiry hearings. And next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, you'll also be hearing live NPR coverage, a whole slate of those who will be testifying. And we'll share with you during the course of the next hour plus the names of those individuals and what we might expect from that testimony. Our special coverage in this delayed edition of Air Talk and Film Week coming your way throughout the course of this afternoon. We'll have Air Talk the rest of this hour into the 1 o'clock hour as well. And then Film Week will come your way at 2 o'clock with our critics talking about all the major films. But right now, let's take a look at some of the major points that were made during the course of today's second day of open impeachment inquiry. We have Democrats questioning a former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, focusing on her ouster and the way in which that was conducted, the reasons that President Trump appeared to turn against her being the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Here an exchange between the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff of Los Angeles, and the former ambassador Yovanovitch. She had just responded to a tweet sent out by President Trump during the hearing that questioned her professional ability.
Ambassador, you've shown the courage to come forward today and testify, notwithstanding the fact you were urged by the White House or State Department not to, notwithstanding the fact that, as you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record. And now the president in real time is attacking you. What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
It's designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously.
Now, Republicans were critical throughout the course of the day, with Democrats on the Intelligence Committee asking the former ambassador to speculate about the president's motives, about what she thought he was attempting to do. The tweet that was the subject of the exchange you just heard was issued about 5 hours ago by President Trump. He tweeted, "Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? Then fast forward to Ukraine, where the new Ukrainian president spoke unfavorably about her in my second phone call with him. It is the U.S. president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors." Now, if President Trump's referring to the phone call from which we have the rough transcript, we didn't hear anything or see anything in that transcript that was critical of the former ambassador. The president goes on in his tweet this morning, "They call it serving at the pleasure of the president. The U.S. now has a very strong and powerful foreign policy, much different than preceding administrations. It's called quite simply America First. With all of that, however, I've done far more for Ukraine than O," the O referring to President Obama. There also was a Republican strategy that was clearly on display today to bolster the president's claims that Ambassador Yovanovitch was not following through on the sorts of investigation of corruption that she should have been. And the spotlight returned to Hunter Biden and his work with the Ukrainian gas company Burisma. Here's Elise Stefanik, Republican Congress member from New York.
"The first time you personally became aware of Burisma was actually when you were being prepared by the Obama State Department for your Senate confirmation hearings. And this was in the form of practice questions and answers. This was your deposition. And you testify that in this particular practice Q&A with the Obama State Department, It wasn't just generally about Burisma and corruption. It was specifically about Hunter Biden and Burisma. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And the exact quote from your testimony, Ambassador, is, quote, "The way the question was phrased in this model Q&A was, what can you tell us about Hunter Biden's, you know, being named to the board of Burisma?" So for the millions of Americans watching, President Obama's own State Department was so concerned about potential conflicts of interest from Hunter Biden's role at Burisma that they raised it themselves while prepping this wonderful ambassador nominee before her confirmation. And yet our Democratic colleagues and the chairman of this committee cry foul when we dare ask that same question that the Obama State Department was so concerned about. But we will continue asking it. And lastly, in my 20 seconds left, I just want to get it on record. In terms of the defensive lethal aid, which you were an advocate for, that was not provided by President Obama. It was provided by President Trump.
That's correct.
The defensive lethal aid talked about aid, of course, to Ukraine for their military defense against Russia and its incursion into Crimea. This air talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're delayed getting on the air because of the impeachment inquiry, day two of the open hearing. Also in major news today, Roger Stone, longtime friend and ally of President Trump, was found guilty today of witness tampering and lying to Congress. This a result of his pursuit of Russian hacked emails damaging to Hillary Clinton's 2016 election bid. Stone was convicted of all seven counts in a federal indictment. It accused him of lying to Congress, tampering with a witness, and obstructing the House investigation into whether the Trump campaign coordinated with Russia to tip the 2016 election. Stone is the sixth Trump aide or advisor to be convicted of charges brought as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Stone has repeatedly denied wrongdoing. He's consistently criticized the case against him as politically motivated. He didn't take the stand during the trial, a surprise to some observers, given how outspoken and media friendly that Stone has been throughout his career, even after he was indicted. Stone's attorneys also did not call any witnesses in his defense. The 67-year-old Stone showed no visible reaction as the verdict was read aloud. His sentencing is scheduled for February 6th. Now, we're going to have a full hour of analysis about the day's political events coming up in 1 o'clock right here on KPCC. Again, Film Week will follow at 2 o'clock, taking us up to Marketplace at 3. That's this afternoon's schedule here on 89.3 KPCC. Good afternoon. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Coming your way, delayed because of NPR's live coverage of the House impeachment inquiry, day two of the open session. Got up to date with some of the details from NPR Hourly News. Just a reminder that we'll be carrying NPR's continuing coverage Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. Within this hour, one of the things that we'll do is preview who's going to be speaking in those hearings and what's expected to be the focus of the questioning of those individuals. But first, let's look at what took place today, where the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was the only witness testifying. Politics editor for Bloomberg, Anna Edgerton, joins us. Anna, good afternoon. So let's talk first about the focus of the hearing. Seemed to me it was very much about the circumstances of the firing of Yovanovitch and what was the motivation behind that. Was that the central issue?
That's right. Yovanovitch had a very compelling, disturbing story to tell about how she, you know, a 33-year career diplomat, was serving the interests of the United States at her post in Ukraine, a very difficult country, a country with lots of challenges, confronting Russian aggression and trying to ally itself more with the European Union and the United States. She was basically the victim of a smear campaign led by Rudy Giuliani, at the time the president's personal lawyer, and some of his associates, and even a Republican congressman at the time. So she recounted how she became aware of this campaign that started without her knowledge, and it eventually led it led to her being recalled from that post in May.
All right. And how does her testimony relate to the issue of whether President Trump intended to pressure Ukraine into going after the Bidens in exchange for the hundreds of billions of dollars in aid? That was something Republicans challenged about that. How did Democrats frame that her being there was relevant to that question?
That is a good question. And like you said, one that Republicans really tried to highlight as being irrelevant to the central allegations in the impeachment inquiry. Adam Schiff, the Intelligence Committee chairman, tried to close that circle at the end of the hearing in his closing statement when he said that Yovanovitch's ouster was the beginning. It was the opening salvo of the story because Giuliani and his associates, even possibly President Trump, would not have been able to demand these investigations that they say were politically motivated if they had an ambassador, a career ambassador in Ukraine that was not on board with that. Now, Marie Yovanovitch was not replaced by a sitting ambassador who was confirmed by the Senate. Our current top diplomat in Ukraine is Bill Taylor, who is there as the chargé d'affaires. So he has not been confirmed by the Senate, although he is, by all accounts, a very respected career public servant.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I thought Bill Taylor testified that he wasn't aware that the aid had been withheld until that was publicized as a part of the whistleblower complaint.
That's right. And he testified on Wednesday, also gave a very interesting depiction of what took place, especially as he was aware of it. And what's interesting about Bill Taylor is the extent to which he was left out of American policy abroad. I mean, he was and continues to be our top diplomat, and yet he didn't know what was going on in what he described as a highly irregular kind of back channel of diplomacy led by Giuliani and Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, was appointed by Trump after donating $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee.
I guess what I wasn't quite clear on is why Trump would need to get rid of Ambassador Yovanovitch as part of getting away from opposition of withholding the money, because if her successor, I realize he's not permanent, but Bill Taylor is essentially performing that duty. If he didn't know, how would Yovanovitch even know that the money was being withheld to object to it?
Well, the decision to withhold the money happened after Yovanovitch left, so it's not clear what role she would have played in that. Part of the complaint against Yovanovitch is that she was a very strong supporter of anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine, especially those led by civil society, which I will add is the stated policy of the United States, set by Congress and the Trump administration to fight corruption in foreign countries. So as Yovanovitch was pursuing this anti-corruption campaign, she was making enemies. another diplomat described, if you fight corruption, you'll make enemies of corrupt people. So there were a few, a former prosecutor, a few others in Ukraine that wanted her gone. And they appeared to enlist Rudy Giuliani in this effort. And he actually participated in this campaign led by corrupt Ukrainians to remove Yovanovitch for her post, possibly in retaliation for her anti-corruption work.
We're talking with Bloomberg Politics editor Anna Edgerton. Anna, there was the tweet from President Trump denigrating the ambassador as she was testifying during today's open hearing. And that raised the question of whether this was an effort of the president to try and intimidate her. That was seized on by the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. That was a theme that was returned to throughout the course of the day's questioning by other Democrats who were on the committee. Obviously, they couldn't have foreseen this was going to happen, but they seized on this quite quickly.
That's right. And we heard that very clearly from Chairman Adam Schiff when he said, we take witness intimidation very seriously, and connected that to other obstruction of Congress, such as executive branch agencies withholding documents that the committees have requested. I mean, that was a really interesting tweet from the president, in that Yovanovitch had given this, kind of passionate description of her biography, of her foreign service She has served in all of these dangerous countries, in Somalia, in Kyrgyzstan, in Russia, and really kind of, in some cases, put her life on the line to serve the interests of the United States. And then the president said in his tweet, wherever she goes, things go wrong, like Somalia, which, of course, the U.S. ambassador doesn't have full control over. So, you know, not only did Democrats construe it as witness intimidation, and we'll see how much that plays into their impeachment strategy, but it was also just a very harsh moment from the president for someone who, by all accounts, is a very sympathetic, upstanding witness.
Yeah, Republicans also have attempted to portray that there is a deep state and that the State Department is sort of the major example of this. Lifelong civil servants who have a particular approach that they want to be able to continue. You get a president who comes in and tweets all the time and shoots from the hip and doesn't necessarily have a consistent policy that they're used to in a president collaborating with them on. How much did Republicans sort of get into that theme that, well, maybe these are State Department people or just they're unhappy with the president who they feel like is a diplomatic bull in a china shop?
That kind of happened from Republican members of Congress that weren't a part of the hearing. We saw a few tweets from people who aren't actually on the Intelligence Committee. But when it came to Intelligence Committee members in the actual hearing, they didn't really go after Yovanovitch, which I thought was interesting. They didn't really question her experience. In fact, a lot of them thanked her for her service. They really used their time to attack Adam Schiff and the process, as they've done throughout this whole thing. But Yovanovitch really gave a kind of compelling, passionate defense of U.S. diplomacy and how important this diplomatic corps is to represent U.S. interests abroad and also to help head off armed conflict. She pointed out that there's so much respect for the military, as there should be, but it's really the diplomatic corps that keeps us out of violent conflict and keeps us from engaging in, you know, more deadly, more expensive conflicts where the United States doesn't need to be involved, if they can head that off with a diplomatic corps.
Anna, thank you. I know you're working on a tight deadline. Really appreciate your taking this time and laying things out from today's testimony. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg, joining us. Also with us is Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Democrat Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. Sean, thank you so much. I know you didn't even know when you get on today, but appreciate your being flexible with us. Let's start, first of all, with any surprises for you, perhaps beyond the president's live tweeting?
No surprise, and President's live tweeting isn't a surprise at all. I will tell you that the Bloomberg political editor, I think, miscalculates a little bit. You could predict, kind of like Pavlov's dog, that President Trump was going to go out and do some sort of tweet. With regard to witness intimidation, the only way the witness would have been intimidated is if Adam Schiff and the Democrats actually read the tweet live while she was doing her testimony to impact her testimony itself. She would not have seen it until she was out of the room. So it was a political stunt on the Democrats' part, and President Trump continually steps in trouble when he goes out and does these issues. Now the question is it illegal? And so let's look at the forest through the trees. So I think that the Democrats are going to put articles of impeachment up. They're going to do bribery, and President Trump probably gave them another one with regards to witness intimidation or witness tampering. But that said, that doesn't change the eventual outcome as to whether it was illegal or not. And in what I saw today, what the president did, he did not do something illegal.
All right. Sean, I want to come back to you and talk about the tweet in a little more detail. But let me bring Amanda Renteria, chair of Emerge America, into our conversation, national organization that identifies and trains Democratic women to run for political office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Amanda, thank you for being with us again. Just as I asked Sean, any surprises for you in today's testimony or exchanges?
Not surprising. I mean, I've heard a lot about Ambassador and all the respect that she has within the organization, and I think that really showed today. I think what was a little bit of a surprise is that the president engaged. You know, it very different tactic than Monday saying, I'm not watching this thing, you know, I'm not paying attention. I think the surprise for a lot of folks was he actually was paying attention and, in fact, felt so compelled to jump in, I think, which was an indication of how much, how well she came across and how honest and authentic and really her story just resonated with so many people who are tuning in today.
Well, and in the tweet, the president attempting to portray her as incompetent and that trouble follows her and uses Somalia as an example, that seemed to have potentially the unintentional effect of further gaining sympathy for her and not necessarily hurt her reputation that the president would attack her for that.
Right, and she obviously was ready for it. She's been in some really complicated places. I mean, you heard her talk about it, the way she presented it. There's no doubt that she has seen this. I think the shocking part, and you could really read that on her, is that it was happening here in her country, and she was the person, you know, on the stand, if you will. And so I think you saw what we see in a lot of public servants, particularly career public servants who have spent their life doing this. I think the country got to see what that looks like, what a very talented woman dedicated to this country and the kind of work they do and the seriousness they do it with.
Amanda, certainly understand the circumstances of the ambassador's firing are cause for concern. What's a little less clear is why she was part of this hearing, because it wouldn't seem that she relates directly to this question of whether President Trump was using the leverage of the U.S. financial support to coerce, to force Ukraine into investigating the Bidens. So how did you see it as the reason why she would be part of the impeachment inquiry?
I think the way Congressman Schiff was looking at her testimony, but really this entire conversation, is how do you build the full context of what was happening here? And what were all the different ways that perhaps this administration was trying to use different influence or trying to do things that were out of step with the norm of what we've seen in our foreign policy? You have to remember, foreign policy is not an area that American public has been very engaged in. And in fact, even when you were on the Hill, it's very much a discussion within the foreign policy space, Department of State, very much coming out of the executive branch in the White House. And so in some ways, this is really educating a public about how things work. And there's no doubt that a part of that discussion is going to extend beyond the particular conversation, but it gives you a sense of the way he's been leading foreign policy and the way foreign policy should be led is, I think, part of the case that Schiff is trying to make and really talk about how different this is. And particularly her testimony does leave you to wonder, you know, here's a woman that has been fighting corruption. Why was she moved aside? And I think that piece of it will stick and will begin to raise some questions in the public to say what was going on that this woman who has been fighting corruption her whole entire life had to be moved aside. So that leaves, you know, that's a picture that obviously Congressman Schiff wanted to present, but I think it does give context for the overall way in which this administration works.
Sean Walsh, what did you think? Was her appearance a relevant part of the impeachment inquiry?
Well, it's a relevant part insofar as that impeachment is inherently a political process. And so did she add anything on the legal side? No. I will tell you, the Democrat strategy in this process, and some people feel deeply that the president did break the law, but the Democratic strategy on this is to continue to undermine the president and undermine his credibility, and this carries forward into the next election cycle. I found it interesting when they did the break and C-SPAN actually was doing coverage, most of the mail callers were fairly pro-Trump or this is an overreach by Congress, but many of the female callers actually were bothered by that and were very much bothered by President Trump attack on this gal. And I think it is a political strategy and a smart one on the Democrats' part to continue on what happened in the last election cycle where the Democrats took back Congress, is to keep chipping away at both Democratic women to get much more motivated to go out there and to put more Trump fatigue on Republican women and to walk away from him. So I think Adam Schiff is doing this with Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the Democratic leadership for political gain in the next election cycle.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation. That's Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Amanda Renteria, analyzing for us on the Democratic side. She chairs Emerge America. We also have legal scholars who'll be joining us, like William C. Banks. We had him on Wednesday and had a bad phone line. He's back with us under better circumstances. I want to hear what he has to say. Also from the University of Michigan, Professor Barbara McQuaid and David Rifkin, who also a former White House counsel and with the Department of Justice. You're listening to Air Talk, coming your way later today because of day two of the open house impeachment inquiry hearings. We'll be back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a reminder, Film Week coming up at 2 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPECC. We look forward to you hearing about some big films like Ford versus Ferrari and many others that are on the schedule, even a Charlie's Angels new version of that. Joining us now, Professor Emeritus, Harvard University School of Law and author of The Case Against Impeaching Trump, Alan Dershowitz. Professor, thank you for being with us. Your takeaway from today's hearing.
Well, it was a very interesting debate about the role of diplomacy and whether diplomacy ever should try to influence domestic elections, either our efforts to try to influence elections abroad or. But I didn't hear anything about impeachment. I didn't hear anything about crimes. I didn't hear anything about any activities that could rise to the level of bribery, treason, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. We know that presidents fire ambassadors for all kinds of reasons, including if the ambassador didn't raise enough money for him in the last election. And we know that there are efforts by diplomats in one country to try to influence the election of another country. You know, if Congress wanted to make that a crime, they could probably do it. It wouldn't be easy to frame the statute, but they could probably do it. But you just can't make up crimes if you want to impeach a president. You have to look to the statute books to see whether or not the elements of the impeachment criteria have been met. And I just didn't hear anything yesterday or today that changes my view that there are some good reasons not, you know, to decide who to vote for. But I didn't see any good reasons for removing an elected president through the mechanisms of impeachment.
So the narrative that was laid out today by the Democratic majority is that Ambassador Yovanovitch is removed because she is an honest broker, that she is going to make it difficult for the president to wheel and deal essentially with Ukraine to get what are his priorities. And that's sort of the narrative that that Democrats are laying out. Is that not relevant to impeachment in the sense that what's being looked at is a potential quid pro quo with Ukraine? And this sort of sets up the steps to the front door of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And again, that's good policy arguments. But even if there were quid pro quo, the president is entitled to demand actions in exchange for foreign aid. All presidents do that. The question is, can he demand actions which help him politically? Presidents do that, too. They try to get an advantage. This may have gone further than other presidents have gone. And those are, again, good reasons, policy reasons for deciding who to vote for. But where's the line to be drawn for crime? And it's very dangerous for Congress to make up crimes out of things that they don't like. You know, I don't like some of it either, but I just can't find the crime. So, no, I don't think it's irrelevant for impeachment. You know, when the impeachment debate was going on among the framers in the Constitutional Convention, a group of framers said, let's impeach presidents if they engage in maladministration. This is a good example of potential maladministration, but the framers of the Constitution rejected that, and they said that would give too much power to Congress. We need to have specific criteria, treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. So I don't think that the framers would approve of the use of impeachment for the activities that we're hearing evidence about. Look, this ambassador struck me as very impressive, very professional, very likable, and I think she was treated unfairly And all of those are good arguments for deciding who you want to be president. But I don't see any of them rising to the level of an impeachable offense.
Professor Dershowitz, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Alan Dershowitz, Professor Emeritus, Harvard University. Let me go to also legal scholar, Professor Emeritus of Law at Syracuse University, William C. Banks, co-author of Constitutional Law, Structure and Rights in Our Federal System. Professor, thank you so much. Good to have you back. After Wednesday, we had some technical problems with your line. You want to respond, first of all, to what we just heard from Professor Dershowitz?
I would do that. Yes, I disagree at the bottom that this was about crimes. Today is part of a larger picture about the case for impeachment, and it's not based on meeting the definition of some crime in the United States Criminal Code. It's about whether the President of the United States abused his oath of office, and I think the Democrats are making the case that this president did that. I think the ambassador today, while not relevant to the July telephone call, as you pointed out a few moments ago, is part of the fabric, if you will, of the president creating a sort of shadow foreign policy for Ukraine that is designed to further his own political interests with respect to investigating the Bidens and his theory about the involvement of Ukraine in the 2016 election. So whether or not there's a quid pro quo, whether or not anything that the president did in dismissing the ambassador constituted a crime is neither here nor there, it seems to me.
Professor, when you mentioned impeachment is about violating the oath of office, what does that mean? What are the kinds of things that are a direct violation of the oath if it's not based on statute?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as I agree to some degree with what Professor Dershowitz said, the framers debated the terms and conditions for impeachment at some length in the Constitutional Convention. And they brought their understanding of the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors from England. And there it referred to very serious abuses of office, not simple maladministration, as I think Professor Dershowitz was saying. I agree with that. But very significant maladministration that would arise to the level of an abuse of office. So the oath is the only portion of the president's duties that's contained in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution that sort of captures the idea of public trust and the responsibility that he or she has to maintain the integrity of the office. Running a foreign policy in the Ukraine for your own personal benefit is not maintaining the integrity of the office or the public trust.
And determined in one's own interest, that means if it benefits politically gains an electoral advantage or financial, is that pretty broadly defined what that means?
It is broadly defined, I think. And I think most experts on impeachment would agree with that. So that the case that's being built here is not about bribery or about a quid pro quo or about whether it was lawful to fire his ambassador. It's about whether he's violating the public trust and carrying out a foreign policy to serve his own political interests.
And so then what to you needs to be proved? Or do you think nothing, that it's clear even from the rough transcript of the phone call that he violates the oath there? Is that sufficient?
Well, I think the more that the witnesses can corroborate what the whistleblower first reported, I think the stronger the case will be. You know, some people have complained about hearsay testimony that can't be validated by the witness himself or herself. So the closer we get to that, the more that the individuals who've listened in on phone calls or now the couple who've listened in on Ambassador Sondland's cell phone call with the president. I guess we've heard from one of those individuals, and apparently a second one will testify sometime in the near future.
Going on right now, I think, is they're being deposed.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so.
That's right. So I think those strengthen the case. And, you know, it's important, I think, for people to understand that, again, this is not a trial. There'll be a trial in the Senate, perhaps. This is the rough equivalent of a grand jury investigation, if you want a litigation analogy. So here we're collecting evidence, we're collecting information, and then it would be up to the trial in the Senate to decide just how good that evidence or that information is.
We're talking with Professor Emeritus of Law, Syracuse University, William C. Banks, co-author of the book Constitutional Law. We're getting his sense of today's second day of open impeachment inquiry hearings. We brought you NPR's live coverage, which we'll also be doing next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday here on 89.3 KPCC. Just a programming reminder, coming up at 2 o'clock, Film Week, the full hour of movie reviews on a very big week in the movies. That's coming up shortly. Professor Banks, the fact that there's not a single Republican who is supporting this effort, does that cause you concern, or do you think that it is just sort of anomalous because of the nature of President Trump and the political fear that's instilled in Republicans?
I hope it's an anomaly because of the significance of the Trump presidency. It's very discouraging, I think, and doesn't bode well, I think, for obtaining the president's removal. In the Nixon case, which I'm old enough to remember, you know, the partisan differences began to melt away as the evidence built toward the president's involvement in a cover-up of the Watergate conspiracy. One of the main differences between then and now, of course, is that the president himself eventually cooperated with the investigation for the most part. In the end, of course, he had to give up the tapes about the conversations, causing him to resign. But even before that, he agreed with allowing a bunch of information, incriminating information, to be given over to the investigators. The White House and President Trump himself has really stonewalled this investigation and looked to the courts to rescue him, or the delay that would be caused by litigation to rescue him from having to comply. So there's very little to cause his Republican colleagues to swim away from what could be a sinking ship.
Professor, I want to thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much. William C. Banks, Syracuse University, Professor Emeritus. Coming up, we'll talk with University of Michigan Professor of Law, Barbara McQuaid. She was U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. We'll also talk with David Rifkin a little bit later this hour. We have many other guests over the course of this hour. We're providing analysis on today's second day of the open impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill. Film Week coming up at 2, but first, time for a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Coming up in 20 minutes, it's a delayed Film Week, but you'll hear it in its entirety. Tim Cogshell, Justin Chang, Charles Solomon, our critics this week. They'll tell us about Ford versus Ferrari, a new Charlie's Angels, and The Good Liar. Helen Mirren, Ian McKellen. What great stars to have in that film. Directed by Bill Condon, who did the wonderful movie Gods and Monsters a number of years ago. We'll hear about those and many more films coming up right here on 89.3 KPCC. But right now, our focus on day two of the open impeachment inquiry hearings and the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and her testimony. With us, professor at University of Michigan School of Law, Barbara McQuaid. Professor, thank you very much for being with us. Your thoughts about the significance of the day's testimony, and did it further Democrats' interest in impeachment?
I thought it was a significant day, and I did think it advanced the ball. I think one of the things that she was able to demonstrate was the harm that is being caused to the United States in the world as a result of this conduct. I think that there are some people who are inclined to say, you know, I get it. Trump doesn't follow the rules. He looks for every advantage for himself. But what's the big deal, right? No harm, no foul. The FDA didn't go through, the investigations weren't announced, let's move on, we've got bigger fish to fry. But I think her testimony was incredibly compelling about the harm that is being done to our credibility abroad and our ability to advance the foreign policy of the United States. She said something really powerful, I thought, when she talked about the fact that part of her mission is fighting corruption, and she was kneecapped as a result of it. And, you know, who benefits from kneecapping those who fight corruption but the corrupt people themselves?
Professor, one of the arguments that Republicans have made is that if President Trump is doing harm to Americans' interests diplomatically, that that's an issue to be decided by voters. That's something that Democratic opponents of the president in the election can run on, is that he's messed up U.S. foreign policy, put the U.S. in a less secure place around the world. Their argument is that's not impeachment worthy, that it, you know, could be incompetence, but that's not impeachable. Your response to that?
I would say that would be true if he were overtly saying it is my policy to do X and he was effectuating it and people simply disagreed with it as a policy matter. Instead, he is doing something that is underhanded, covert. He is smearing an honorable public servant by saying things about her that are not true. And he is not advancing policy to advance the interests of the United States, but to promote his own interests. You know, he has been tweeting America first, but I think a more apt slogan might be Trump first.
Professor, and how does this reach the level of impeachment? What are the aspects of the president's conduct that you think are very clearly impeachable and should lead to his impeachment?
Well, a couple of things I think that are particularly harmful to the United States when you think about the reasons that the framers of the Constitution wanted to have impeachment available was their concern about foreign influence in our policy and in our elections. By inviting Ukraine to provide information or even an announcement of an investigation that could influence the outcome of our election, he did one of the very things that the framers of the Constitution warned about. The other thing that he did was abuse his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, putting his personal interests ahead of those of the country when he withheld military aid that Congress had already approved because they believed it to be in the best interest of our national security to provide it. It's there to prevent Russian aggression and to prevent Russia from advancing toward Europe. We had agreed to help Ukraine, and instead President Trump withheld that for months because he wanted to use it as leverage to get that announcement of an investigation. And so I think both by inviting foreign influence and by compromising the interests of the United States, he has committed impeachable offenses.
Professor McQuaid, had the president withheld the money on the condition that there be greater anti-corruption investigations in Ukraine, something similar to what the Obama administration did when Joe Biden was the point person on the Ukraine policy, would that have been acceptable in your view? Was what crosses the line that the Bidens are brought up or the 2016 election is brought up? What makes it different from what the Obama administration conducted?
My understanding of what the Obama administration was interested in was ensuring that Ukraine was fighting corruption. Before we gave them money, we wanted to ensure that it would be used for the purposes that we sought and not to advance a corrupt regime. That is advancing the national interests of the United States. Instead, what we see with regard to President Trump is asking them to announce that they're involved in investigations that have no basis. George Kent testified earlier this week that the theory that Hunter Biden had been involved in corruption with Burisma had been debunked, that it was not a valid theory. It was a baseless theory. And so it wasn't a genuine investigation that Trump was pursuing, but an attempt to smear a political opponent.
There is, of course, the argument that it's a clear conflict of interest for the son of the vice president to accept this highly paid position given that it appears he didn't have the experience and that he was likely hired because of his closeness to his father. Is that anything to be followed up on by the Trump administration or not?
I agree with you. I think it was a terrible decision for Hunter Biden to accept that position, because I think it creates at least the appearance that he's there only because of his access to his father. If he lacked the qualifications to be there, that seems to be the only reason they want him. And he should have exercised the good judgment to decline that. That does not, however, excuse the conduct of President Trump.
So that is sort of a dead deal, sounds like you're saying, that was inappropriate, potentially a conflict of interest, if not a legal violation, and that's done. Is that essentially your
argument? I think it's over. I don't think there's anything illegal about it, but I think it just creates a perception that he has that job because of the access he can provide to his father, and I think that undermines public confidence in our institutions of government. So I think it's a bad decision on his part, and you know, I guess Joe Biden can't always control the decisions of his adult children, but he should have talked him out of it or done his best to do so. Maybe he did, and we just don't know it, but I think Hunter Biden made a mistake by accepting that position.
We're talking with Professor Barbara McQuaid, legal scholar at the University of Michigan. She was U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan up until just a couple of years ago. Let me go back to Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. Sean, your response to the points that the professor is making here, that what the president has engaged in for his benefit is clearly impeachable.
Well, I don't like what Nick Mulvaney did when he went into the White House press briefing room and said, of course, politics gets into foreign policy issues. I have not heard the professor say anything that crosses the line with regards to a criminal indictable offense. Granted, you can't indict a sitting president, but criminal acts. You are going to see, and again, forest through the trees, I think you're going to see that this House of Representatives bring up impeachment charges on bribery, witness intimidation, and probably whatever else they can actually do. With regards to foreign policy issues, though, the president, under the Constitution, has broad latitude to do many, many things. And with regards to what she said about Hunter Biden, I mean, Joe Biden went into the Council of Foreign Relations and bragged about the fact that he compelled the Ukraine government to take some action because he didn't like something along those lines. With regards to withholding weapon systems, the Congress passed military aid to Ukraine under the Obama administration, and the Obama administration decided not to do what Congress wanted and withheld those actually lethal weapons. So, you know, I'm not saying that the Obama administration did something criminally wrong. What I am saying is that foreign policy has a lot of different rationales on why people do certain things, what they actually want to see from a government. And I don't think what the Obama administration did was illegal. And right now, I've not seen anything to demonstrate what the Trump administration has done is illegal.
Well, and again, I don't think the argument is that impeachment is tied to actual statutes. As we heard earlier from Professor Banks, it's not the same threshold as that. And, you know, to the point, as we just heard from Professor McQuaid, that the context very different, she would argue, for what the Obama administration did in withholding the funds when you've got a prosecutor in Ukraine generally regarded not just by U.S., but by other countries as being corrupt and not, honestly dealing with corruption in Ukraine, that's on behalf of a greater good aside from Joe Biden or Barack Obama than is what alleged in the case with President Trump, where it's specific political benefit that's being alleged. But we'll continue our conversation on Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Reminder, Film Week coming up in just 9 minutes. I'll be back in one. Our analysis of the House impeachment inquiry continues with Attorney David Rivkin, previously held positions in the Department of Justice, in the Office of White House Counsel, and elsewhere in the federal government. Ms. Rivkin, we thank you very much for being with us. Rudy Giuliani's and two associates' names came up repeatedly today, as they did Wednesday. My question for you is about the president, his coordination with his attorney, Mr. Giuliani, and others, is this something that feeds into a case for impeachment?
Not at all. It certainly gets us into a discussion about the policy merits of it, but I don't see how coordinating with your attorney or having a particular type of policy exercise that bypasses the normal channels or maybe even bypasses what has been articulated as official policy is a high crime and misdemeanor. So say I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago that looked at this in a historical perspective. Look, we have had presidents, dozens of presidents, going back to Washington, who used unofficial emissaries to drive policy. George Washington was a perfect example. If you remember, there was something called the Jay Treaty. Guess who negotiated the Jay Treaty? Chief Justice Jay, okay, who was Justice of the United States Supreme Court, not a foreign policy maven. And lots of other examples going back to Wilson and FDR and Kennedy and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Were they, though, working on behalf of the political interests of the presidents involved?
Well, the question you have to ask, and it's another point I'm arguing that Wall Street Journal piece is, look, as long as you're doing something that, whether you agree with the merits of his policy or not, is a legitimate exercise of president's discretionary authority. Let's step back and say, let's forget whether it was Mr. Biden or Burisma or something like that. We had a legitimate interest in eradicating corruption in Ukraine. Agree or disagree, I'm sure he agrees, point one. Point two, eradicating corruption or any other misconduct by a government, it's useful to look at what happened in the past to make sure it doesn't occur. So eradicating corruption in Ukraine and looking at the instances of past corruption to make sure it doesn't occur is perfectly legitimate. Now, of course, the answer from those who think it's high crime and misdemeanor is, well, the president is doing it to benefit his political interests. Let me submit the following simple proposition. Everything a politician does advances in some ways your political interests. Let me ask you this. If President Trump were to call Chairman Xi of China and say, you know what, give me a really good deal for U.S. economy and trade. Oh, and by the way, it would really help me win elections. Would that be a high crime and misdemeanor? Can you think of something that was done by a president that did not have some political dimension to it? So democracy.
Okay, but the question would be, in the case of Rudy Giuliani, does it extend beyond just a political benefit? Is there a benefit to the United States in the work Rudy Giuliani is doing in Ukraine?
How it depends upon how you assess the national interest, okay? Woodrow Wilson used a private person, okay, Colonel Hopkins, to be the lead negotiator for the Paris peace talks. Drove them, not the State Department. Let's assume for a second that you think what Rudy Giuliani was doing vis-a-vis Ukraine was a good thing policy-wise. Debatable proposition, to be sure, and not my area. I'm not even going to opine in this. But there's nothing that says that using a private individual, your lawyer or a private emissary, to advance a plausible foreign policy goal, wise or unwise, so high crime and misdemeanor. I mean, I've always, do you remember the whole mess with Iran-Contra? Do you remember all those characters that were involved, taking cakes in the shape of the Bible and all sorts of, in addition to Ali Noor, who of course was at the NAC, all sorts of private individuals involved? Well, over a dozen. Long report by the commission set up to examine it. Lots of lessons drawn. I don't remember anybody suggesting that President Reagan should be impeached for it.
I thank you, David Rifkin. Appreciate your being with us. Partner in the law firm Baker Hostetler, previously held positions in the Department of Justice and the Office of White House Counsel. Let me go back to Professor Barbara McQuaid, University of Michigan. Your response to Mr. Rifkin's points.
Well, I think while a president could send an individual emissary to negotiate matters overseas, that person has to be acting in the interest of the United States. Rudy Giuliani himself has frequently said he is acting for his client, Donald Trump, privately, personally. And that is what makes it an abuse of power. President Trump is acting to advance his own personal self-interest above the interests of the country. And that's what makes it an impeachable offense. Two men have already been indicted, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. These are men who have been working with Rudy Giuliani to make connections for him, to advance the causes that he is seeking, to get this investigation going against Joe Biden so that there can be an announcement that President Trump can use. If you look at the testimony that was said the other day between Bill Taylor and George Kent, one of the things they said is all they wanted was a microphone. That's all they needed, is just an announcement. If he were truly interested in solving the problem of corruption, he would be less interested in the announcement and more interested in the substance. All he wanted was an announcement that he could then use as a talking point. And he was using Rudy Giuliani to do it, I submit, because Rudy Giuliani was not subject to the kinds of rules and record keeping and transparency and Freedom of Information Act that would be required for a government employee. And so I think, although these are not things that are per se illegal, they provide evidence of the abuse of power.
Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it very much. That's Professor Barbara McQuaid joining us from the University of Michigan. My thanks to our terrific AirTalk team, who've been working very long hours to bring you a terrific group of guests. Sean Walsh, Republican analyst, also with us. Our thanks to Sean. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio and Natalie Chudnovsky. Lindsay Wright and Chris Greenspan helped us. Our news apprentices, Sabrina Fang and Julia Murray. Parker McDaniels and Sean Campbell, our engineers this week. And our senior producer is Fiona Ng. Appreciate all their wonderful work. Film Week comes your way next.